You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, there's a lot going on. You know, the NRA has a new home defense course. Yes. No, seriously. Yep. Hey, put a gun in your kid's room. Everything will be fine. I mean, what could possibly go wrong, right? It's not like they're ever going to look over your shoulder and figure out the combination to the lock. And the NRA has a new president and, you know, lots of interesting things. Oh, and Texas now has said they're going to nullify federal laws. So we've got four states now that have joined the Confederate sort of movement. Alan Corwin is the author and publisher of Gun Laws of America website, gunlaws.com. And Alan, welcome to the program, or welcome
great
back to the program.
Good to be with you again, Tom.
Good to have you with us. It seems to me that even for somebody who is as gung-ho for the Second Amendment as you are, that the NRA having a for two out of the 3 days of their, the first two out of the third day was only half a day of their convention, having a zombie statue of Obama that you could shoot at that bleeds real blood, and having a new president who refers to the Civil War as the War of Northern Aggression has to be a little over the top.
I miss those things. I was there for the 3 days. It was filled with decent-looking people to me, and a lot of interesting seminars, a lot of exhibits, bunch of good people, Tom. I miss the over-the-top stuff you're talking about, a lot of scholars, a lot of lawyers, a wonderful, fine exhibition of decent Americans. That's what I saw.
Well, I'm glad that that's what you saw. That, and I'm sure that, you know, some large part of the NRA convention was that. And, you know, I'm not saying we need to get rid of our guns. I think that our gun violence problem in the United States is part of a larger violence problem, which is part of an inequality problem as much as a gun problem. In fact, I think the biggest problem, if you wanted to identify something that probably would go down if fewer guns were available, are accidental shootings and suicides.
I think the biggest problem right now is hoplophobia and the people who are mental cases who aren't being given adequate treatment. The hoplophobic reaction to Newtown was astronomical. People see this one maniac do a horrific act, and their reaction is to disarm innocent people who didn't do anything. That is strictly phobic. It's not going to...
Well, I don't know of any legislation that has been proposed to disarm anybody of anything. Do you, really?
Well, yes. If you look at the Manchin-Toomey bill or the Schumer bills, they would take away property people already own.
They would not. They would simply require people selling guns at gun shows to do the exact same thing that happens when I go into a real store, you know, a regular gun store, and buy a firearm from a licensed gun dealer, and
that's
that is check my background.
The Feinstein bill would illegalize.
The Feinstein bill was never introduced.
Property people already own.
The Feinstein bill never got a vote from anybody. I mean, it never got...
The Feinstein bill would make it illegal to own property that people already own. Regular-size magazines, the kind the police use to defend against criminals.
Okay, first of all, I agree with Dianne Feinstein, and I think it's a good thing that we bring back the assault weapons ban, but let's be clear about it. The Feinstein bill was never a bill.
Well, she...
There is no Feinstein bill.
Because nobody would support it, but the plan...
Well, she couldn't get enough support to get the, you know, and she couldn't even get it on as an amendment to Toomey. But you know, this is a straw man argument. Are you seriously saying that you think that if somebody walks into a licensed gun dealer, into a regular gun shop, and which is about 60% of gun sales in the United States, and says, you know, I'd like that 40 caliber Smith & Wesson there, you know, and they say, okay, you know, I need your name and address, and it's going to take about 2-3 minutes here while I pump this into the FBI database. And, you know, that if that happens also in gun shows where more than 75 vendors are present, which seems to be like a huge loophole, that somehow that's going to be the end of the Second Amendment?
Well, this isn't straw man. In New York, they made it illegal to have a magazine that holds more than seven rounds.
We're not talking about that. I'm talking about the background check bill that just got defeated in the United States Senate, and the House won't even bring up because they don't want to go on record with this thing. You know, the last thing John Boehner and Eric Cantor want is to go on record with this.
We're going to end up going all over the block. The Manchin-Toomey bill, which I have in front of me, is a gun registration bill. That's the part that defeated it. If you take the gun...
It is not a gun registration bill. In fact, it's specifically paragraph 2 of that. If you have it in front of you, you can read it out loud to our listeners. It specifically prohibits a gun registry in the United States.
It actually allows gun registration. I have it right here.
Read me the language.
I have it right here.
Read me the language where it says that, you know, there shall be no gun registry, no national gun registry.
Well, it says prohibition of national gun registry, and it doesn't say what a registry is.
Alan, it actually says prohibition of gun registry. That's the title, right?
That's
read
right.
The sentence that follows that.
Now, wait a minute, Tom.
Let's read the sentence.
Let's do this right. I wrote the unabridged guide to federal gun law.
Yeah.
If you don't define a term, then it can be anything. So the government could make a list, a database, a record, a book, a roster. Those aren't a registry. So it could make a roster of everybody who has a gun, and that's not a registry. So it's not outlawed.
You know, Alan, by and large, that's already available.
Listen, stop for a minute.
I can sell you a list right now of you know, hundreds of thousands of gun owners in America.
Not a registry.
No, but I mean, the lists are available. The NRA sells them.
But that's not a registry, so the government isn't restricted. If you took this language out, you wouldn't have the resistance you have. But
if you took this language out, you would have 10 times as much resistance because that language prohibits the government from having a gun. And there's already a law on the books that says that the government cannot have a gun registry. And that law defines what a registry is, and this law simply refers to that. So, as you know, the definition already exists at law.
It doesn't refer to that at all. Let's look at it this way. Right now, you have to send the name and address of everybody who buys a gun to the FBI. That's the way the system's set up, right?
And the FBI is forbidden from keeping a list of all those names and addresses.
That's not what it says, and this is too complex.
That's not what it says in that piece of legislation. That's what the law already says. This is a law that was passed, 8 or 10 years ago?
1986, Federal Firearms Owners Protection
Thank you.
Act. And Eric Holder has already violated that with what he calls a demand letter, and he's making a list. But he doesn't call it a registry, and so he's making the list.
Alan, we're talking with Alan Corwin, his website, gunlaws.com. Are you one of these folks who thinks that Obama is going to come up with a list and someday show up at your house with a SWAT team and say, give us all your guns?
I don't want to change the subject to that.
Well, only reason it seems that you could be so hysterical about this would be that, isn't it?
Let's not change the subject. Let's do one thing.
Well, could you just tell me whether or not you're one of the, you think that that's a possibility?
I won't keep diverting the subject before we get anything done, Tom. Let's do things one at a time.
So you're not going to answer my question.
Why would you want to send the name and address of everybody who buys a gun to the FBI instead of sending...
So you can find out if they're criminals or crazy? So you can find out if they're criminals or crazy before you sell them a gun?
Why not send the list of the people who are criminals and crazy to the dealers so the dealers can look you up?
That's great. So you want 10 or 20 or 30,000 Americans around the United States of all political persuasions, you want liberal gun store owners to have a list of all the people who've been adjudicated violent and crazy in their neighborhood or community that they could leak to the local newspaper or that they could publish on the web.
Well, that would be a crime. These are the people you're trusting to...
But I thought you can't stop crimes with laws, therefore you shouldn't have laws.
Why are you saying that?
Because that's the NRA argument against gun laws. You're never going to stop gun
argument. That's not your argument.
No, it's of course.
That would allow a background check without a registry, and then people would support it. That would be reasonable.
Okay.
In other words,
Alan, I'm going to leave you with the last word. Thank you very much. 15 minutes past the hour. Gunlaws.com. Alan Corwin.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what are we going to do with this? I think we've got a larger issue here, and that's a jobs crisis. But what are we going to do with this? Hey, only today and tomorrow left to vote for Jacob Dean for the DFA scholarship competition. You can vote at nn13.democracyforamerica.com and click on the link on the front page of TomHartman.com. You'll find it on our homepage. Jacob, of course, our associate producer emeritus for years and years, and great music and great times. And so the NRA's home defense course that happened over the weekend, the instructor said, put a gun in a safe, in a gun safe, in your child's bedroom. Yeah. And then he had to say, I see some negative emotional response in the audience, or words to that effect. Yep. In fact, here's the exact phrase. He says, how about putting a quick access safe in your kid's room? Good idea or bad idea? We have an emotional pushback to that. Yeah, you think? And this was the NRA crowd. You think that they might go, doesn't sound like such a great idea to me. As I was saying, we have nullification, these nullification laws, Canvas's Second Amendment Protection Act, quote, backs up its state's rights claim with a penalty aimed at federal agents when dealing with made-in-Kansas guns. Guns similar to this have been introduced, a bill similar to this have been introduced into 37 other states, which tells me that the Koch brothers and the American Legislative Exchange Council and, probably Alec, probably have something to do with this. In Missouri, the bill declaring federal gun laws null and void passed by an overwhelming majority in the state house. It's headed for the Senate. This is what led to the Civil War. I was telling a story just a second ago. Louise and I, over the weekend, went to see this movie, A Fierce Green Fire, The Battle for a Living Planet, narrated by Robert Redford and Van Jones and Ashley Judd and Meryl Streep and Isabel Allende. And a remarkable movie. And right around the corner is the Ford Theater, where Lincoln was shot. And we'd never been there. We've lived here in D.C. for going on 3 years, and we'd never been in the Ford Theater. So we walked through the Ford Theater. We walked through the Peterson House across the street where Lincoln died and saw the exhibits and all this kind of stuff. And this is what the states were saying back in 1860. One of them had said that before the election of in November of 1860, and then between the election of November 1860 and the inauguration of Lincoln in March of 1861, six more states said, we're not going to respect federal law anymore. In fact, they went a little farther. I mean, they said, we're not going to respect any federal laws anymore, not just gun laws. But the bottom line is nullification laws violate the Constitution. Even the Heritage Foundation, they issued a fact sheet last year titled Nullification, Unlawful and Unconstitutional, although it doesn't talk about guns in particular. It's very, very interesting. So where do we go with this? What do we do with this? This gun instructor, again, at the NRA meeting this weekend, he said, here's my position on this. If you're worried that your kid is going to try and break into the safe that is in their bedroom with a gun in it, you have a bigger problem than home defense. Oh, really? A curious kid is a bigger problem than defending your home? Well, it may be, actually, because very few people's homes actually get broken into. I mean, if you watch TV, you watch all the TV dramas, and everybody's all hysterical all the time. But the fact of the matter is that odds are your home has never been broken into, and you probably don't know anybody whose home has ever been broken into. If you have, grown up in middle-class America, certainly. Although this is, largely true even in poorer neighborhoods and wealthier neighborhoods. So, but what are we going to do about this? I'm going to actually get into this in a little more detail as we go on through the day. But the net is, when you look, if you read the book The Spirit Level by Wilkinson and Pickett, Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. And you can find information about it at equalitytrust.org.uk. Or equalitytrust.org, I think, just points right to it. What you find is that the more unequal wealth is, or income, I mean, they're looking at wealth, but income, you could do the same thing because the one leads to the other. The more unequal wealth is in a state, the more likely that state is to experience gun violence. and it's a scattergraph, but you can draw a pretty straight line through it. And they chart not just the United States, but also this particular chart is not over at Equality Trust. It's from another study that was done. I don't have it here in front of me. Actually, I may. No, I don't. But we're gonna show it on TV tonight. And they actually showed the Canadian provinces as well. The most unequal wealth distribution Canadian province is about the same as the most equal wealth distribution U.S. state. And what's really interesting is that the Canadian provinces follow the same pattern. The greater the inequality, the greater the violence. The better the inequality, that is, the less inequality, the less the spread between rich and poor, the less violence. Why would this be? Well, because in states or countries that have low levels of inequality, that have high levels of equality, you have higher levels of social mobility, you have a stronger social safety net, you have less anxiety, people are not afraid of falling economically, people are not afraid that if they get sick, their family's going to get wiped out, they're going to lose their home. People, you know, if they lose their job, it doesn't mean the end of their lives. They trust their neighbors more. Yeah, trust is one of the things that they measured, that Wilkinson and Pickett measured. And there's an absolute correlation, again, another one of these amazing scattergraphs. Teenage pregnancies go up with inequality state by state in the United States, country by country around the world. STDs, drug addiction, mental illness, all of it. So let's get our guns under control and let's get our economy under control. And that could start with addressing inequality.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Three tips for fixing inequality: change our tax code, bring back unions, and raise the minimum wage. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with me, and Jim, watching us on Free Speech TV in Largo, Florida. Jim, you've been a gun dealer for 9 years?
Yeah, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, and apparently you know something I don't, so tell me about it.
Well, I can only speak on Florida, but I was a gun dealer for about 9, 10 years during the early 90s, and at the time, and I'm sure it's still the same, all you did was call a phone number in the FDLE, Florida Department of Law Enforcement. You gave them the name, you gave them the Social Security number, and the date of birth, and they did a background check, took them about a minute, and came back with a confirmation number, and that was it. They filled out the paperwork. You kept the paperwork. No one got your paperwork until you gave up your license. Now, they told me I had to give up my license after 9 years because I was doing the transfers out of my home, which was within the actual restraints. I mean, it was legal to do it, but the BATF sent letters out to everyone and said, are they legal? And they said, yeah, well, we don't want them doing it out their home. But that's all it was. Nothing was kept. They weren't allowed to keep it for more than 24, 48 hours, and then they disposed of any record of it.
Yeah, and I think that's by law. I think the law prevents the government from keeping track of anything that might keep track of anybody who owns a gun right now,
right,
both at the state and federal level. Jim, thank you for the correction. Thanks for the information.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Greg in Placidas, New Mexico. Hey, Greg, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. If you think back to the mid-80s, there were a lot of states that had a 18-year-old drinking age. And the conservative messiah, Ronald Reagan, said, no, I want every state to be 21. And some states balked at that. And he said, you don't raise your drinking age to 21, you get no federal highway dollars.
Right. Federal highway dollars is a huge club. It's what Jimmy Carter used to get everybody to drop their speed limits to 55.
Right. So if the states don't want to obey federal laws, fine, no federal funds. And since most of the states that don't want to obey federal laws are red states that suck more out of the economy than they put in, well, it's their loss.
So are you suggesting that these four states that have now passed nullification bills, almost all having to do with guns, but nonetheless, basically they've said, we're not going to respect the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, we're not going to respect federal law, that those states should simply lose federal funds?
Exactly.
That would be interesting. If they started with federal highway funds, that would be...
You don't have to write any new laws. You just say, yeah, okay, you don't respect the laws, you get no money.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. I mean, it worked, like you say, it worked for Ronald Reagan with drinking ages. It worked for Jimmy Carter with speed limits when he was trying to, and successfully did, actually, reduce gasoline consumption in the United States because of the Arab oil embargo. Excellent point, Greg. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching. Jay in Tucson, Arizona, on the TomHartmann.com website. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hi there. You know, I'm a former Texan, so I know a little bit more about Texas, but... For the states that refuse to accept federal laws, I think the military bases could be moved to states that would do respect them. And I just looked it up. There's 25 military installations in the state of Texas employing close to 200,000 people who would be annoyed by the move, but they would certainly add to the economy of their new state and leave some places in Texas a wide place in the road.
Yeah. Well, it's a possibility. I mean, Louise is still talking about just let them go. Let those red states, if they want to secede, let them go. But I don't think they want to secede. They, you know, because they're getting so much more from the federal government than they're giving to the federal government. So, but interesting. No more military bases. This is basically a variation on, I think it was Greg's suggestion that no federal highway funds. So. Interesting. Jay, thanks for the call. That's a good one. Jerry, listening on WWRL in Amityville, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? Yeah,
fine.
I'd like to comment on both the NRA's new president and also on the way the gun lobby and lobbyists in general are politically hijacking the political process. First of all, with respect to the NRA's new president and his comments, it's just further proof to me of how the NRA really stands for no reasonable arguments in favor of their extremist and absolutist position on the Second Amendment. But the problem is that both the gun industry and gun lobby, and both lobbyists and, in my opinion, corporate special interests in general, they're corrupting the political process by being allowed to get in there and politically hijack the political process and weaken and water down any proposed new federal legislation of any kind. And yet we, the American people, are told, in effect, to either take and accept this weak, watered-down, lobbyist-approved-of legislation or get nothing at all. But I think the quality of the legislation itself matters, especially with respect to which side has really won politically at the end of the day. And after all, if all we get with respect to gun legislation is all we get is NRA approved of, ineffective, watered down background checks full of loopholes, then the NRA is won, because the NRA will then use the weaknesses of these very weaknesses in the new laws that they helped create to argue against any gun control legislation. And so I think that we may be better off with no gun legislation than to get something that's approved of by the lobbyists. And it shows how corrupt our whole political system is, in my opinion, that the only kind of legislation we can seem to get these days is that legislation that's either approved of by the corporate special interests or their lobbyists. And I think this shows the need for a constitutional amendment dealing with the whole subject of campaign and lobbying reform.
Yeah. Yeah, we have the best Congress money can buy right now, and that's the original sin. And the original sin behind that original sin is the concept of judicial review, which started in 1803 with Marbury versus Madison. But don't get me started on that. I agree with you, Jerry. We need to get money out of politics. And, you know, there's a whole variety of ways to do it. And once we do it, then we might be able to get laws that actually 90% of Americans do like, or even 70%, you know, as in background checks for everybody, or even laws that 75% of Americans like, you know, lifting the cap on Social Security and making the program solvent forever and making it fully inclusive, or making it Medicare, you know, so Medicare is fully inclusive. It's interesting. Louise had her last treatment, you know, the end of the whole, you know, breast cancer thing last week. And she was in this clinic where this fellow was there to get some kind of therapy, chemotherapy or something. And Louis said he looked like he was 80 years old. And the receptionist was trying to explain to him that even though he had Medicare, he had to pay 20% out of pocket. Now, chemotherapies can cost $100,000 a year. And this is a guy who was living on Social Security, and he literally did not understand what he was. He said, but I thought, you know, Medicare, no. They, you know, since Reagan, the Republicans have been drilling holes in Medicare so that companies like United Healthcare can come in and fill those holes with supplemental programs. And these supplemental programs are so profitable that the CEO of United Healthcare, which is the largest purveyor of them in the United States, they're the exclusive purveyor through the AARP, which is basically just an insurance company. It's like a, you know, remember the insurance agent down the street who used to always, you know, knock on your door and hassle you and try and get you to, you know, connect your friends to him. And I don't know, it's kind of from another generation. But in any case, that's kind of the AARP with regard to United Healthcare. To the extent that Stephen J. Hemsley, the CEO of United Healthcare, has taken over $1 billion in income. In remuneration in various forms, most of its stock, has taken over $1 billion or stock options out of United Healthcare. They've got 100 executives making over $1 million a year by drilling holes in Medicare and then saying, we'll sell you a policy to fill a hole. And I'm guessing that this guy didn't have one of those policies, or maybe he had a policy and it had a 20% copay beyond a certain point. I don't know the story. I wasn't there. Louise didn't walk up and say, you know, I'd like to get the details for my husband's radio and TV show, but you know, whatever it was, this poor guy. I mean, this should not be how it is in America. So the NRA, you know, they don't 80-year-old trying to get medical treatment. It's not our issue. Where our issue is, crazies should be allowed to have guns. And I say that, you know, I don't mean to diss people who have mental illness, but let's be clear about this. People who have been adjudicated violently mentally ill and violent, you know, the wife beaters, people who have a history of, you know, starting bar fights to the point that they've been, you know, sent to a mental hospital for it. The NRA wants to make sure that they have the right to buy a gun. John in Round Hill, Virginia. Hey, Ron.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Fine. What's your you don't think this should be up for a vote?
Oh no,
background checks.
Definitely not up for a vote. You know, the Constitution of the United States is solid about our freedoms, our right to bear arms, and it's not up.
Well, our
for
right
vote.
To bear arms is so that
you
we can have a well-regulated militia. Where is that?
Voting for slavery,
John. Where is the well-regulated militia that gives us the right to bear arms?
Tom.
Pardon?
It's not well regulated. It's the personal right to bear arms.
No, the Second Amendment says a well regulated militia being necessary for the freedom of for the protection of a free state, or words to that effect. I can dig it out.
You have to keep reading. It says the personal right to bear arms.
It doesn't say personal. It says the right to bear. Well, actually, let's read it word for word. Okay. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's plural. By the way, for what it's worth, but it you know, if free speech, which doesn't have the word regulated in the First Amendment, can be regulated, and you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, so can the right of telling a gun.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And besides that, this legislation didn't even have to do with owning a gun. Well, I guess it did if you're mentally ill. Again, we're back to the violently mentally ill people. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, the place where despair is not an option. Frank in Hartford, Kansas. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Sir, please excuse me. First time caller, terrified.
Oh, that's quite all right.
Okay, there is going to be a website called Pro, and it will stand for the Patriotic Rifle Organization.
Okay.
And, of course, its web address will be patrioticrifle.org.
Okay.
And mission statement is to defend Second Amendment rights, mm-hmm. to promote domestic gun nonviolence by supporting every single program that was presented to Congress to end these awful, awful killings. I know there's tons of disaffected NRA members
mm-hmm.
that, you know, want their rights protected. That's fair.
Mm-hmm.
But they also would like to see an end to semi-automatic rifles
right.
with 40-round magazines.
Right. In other words, you've got rational NRA members who'd like to see the assault weapon ban come
right.
back.
Right. Now, this, yeah. This okay. site is not up and running. I have one Emporia State College kid working on it.
Mm-hmm.
We won't put it online until it's perfect.
Yeah. Well, Frank, let me just interrupt you then, because you're going to create problems for your kid who's working on it if you continue with this. When you have the site up and running, and I think it's great, you know, the Patriotic Rifle Organization, you know, giving the NRA a run for their money. But when you have it up and running, give us a call, and it's because we would love to talk about it. But right now, if we talk about it, it's frankly, it's not going to, you know, I just, from what little I know about the internet, it won't help you. It might hurt you. Gary in Cottonwood, Arizona. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk with you. Yeah, just a real quick thing about the notification situation. I kind of agree with somewhat of the people that talked about, you know, not letting them have government funds and all that. But the only thing I'd consider be some of the people on Medicaid might be hurt pretty much by that.
Well, that's why I thought that, you know, restricting it to things like either eliminating military bases in those states or cutting off federal highway funds to those states were reasonable solutions that wouldn't hurt
the
social safety net.
The other things that happened when Sandy came along, these are the states that were pissing and moaning about paying, you know, giving them, you know, help up there. And then when they get hurricanes and bad weather, they're the first to ask for government help.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just
no, this was wasn't it the governor of Texas, Governor Goodhair, Rick Perry, who back when Hurricane Sandy happened, the legislation was pushing through Congress to grant, you know, several billion dollars to help the victims of Hurricane Sandy, called that pork. And then, you know, when he had unregulated, shall we say, poorly regulated, not enough federal regulators, I don't know if fill in the blank, anyhow, a libertarian fertilizer plant blow up in West Texas, asked for immediate federal funding. It was Ted Cruz? Oh, it was the senator. Oh, okay. Oh, I thought it was Rick Perry. Same thing. Anyhow, it's not the same thing, actually. Ted Cruz is in all probability going to be running for the White House on the Republican ticket and might even give them a run for their money. I'm increasingly startled by the young conservatives that I talk to on this program and on our TV show who are big Ted Cruz fans. I mean, it's whoa. And he's Cuban American. He's arguably Hispanic. And although Bill Richardson today said, you know, that's not going to trump the fact that he's anti-immigration. So, well, we'll see. Anyhow, Bruce in Palmdale, California. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Hey, how's it going? I got a couple items real quick. First of all, it's amazing how paranoid the gun people are. I mean, I know the NRI is, I mean, they love it because that's how they sell their guns.
Sure.
But they do a great job of, it's just crazy. I've never seen a more paranoid group.
Oh, the gun manufacturers are getting good money for the $2 million that they're giving Wayne LaPierre or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
LaPetite.
The other issue is
Wayne LaPetite.
Yeah.
Pardon me.
Yeah. The other issue is every time I hear one of these politicians say or gun people about restricting or infringing on their Second Amendment rights, it blows my mind because, first of all, most law-abiding citizens go through – we get our rights infringed all the time. I mean, you go to the airport, you
mm-hmm.
know, I drive a truck, I go through border checks. I mean
mm-hmm.
You know, and the other point about law-abiding citizens, how many times does a quote-unquote law-abiding citizen who gets into a fight with his wife or girlfriend pulls out that gun and kills them?
Yeah.
They were law-abiding up until that point.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, or even more sadly, the 11,000 suicides a year where people, you know, just grabbed a gun and bang, and that was it. It's made so much more easy, you know, knowing that that's possible, that's a quick and easy and convenient way out. So, I'm with you, Bruce. Thanks a lot for the call. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, Corky, got a minute to the end of this hour. What's up?
Oh, great. I'll take it all. These gun rights lobbyists, I've been looking for a way to say it, but I heard Lawrence O'Donnell say it on Bill Maher's show.
Okay.
The days of armed revolution against your country are over. They're over.
Yeah.
You can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're so hopped up about defending your country with a gun, I got a perfect place. I got a place over there in Afghanistan. Why don't you sign up?
Yeah. Well, you know, and
turn around here and pound your chest to what a man you are.
Yeah. Well, and the fact of the matter is that, you know, arguably the Civil War was a war against our government. But the Revolutionary War wasn't. The Revolutionary War was an attempt by colonists in North America to say no to what, by that point in time, you know, they've been here over 100 years, what had become a foreign and occupying force in their mind, Great Britain. And so any kind of analogies or parallels, Corky, thanks for the call, any kind of analogies, parallels to the Revolutionary War, I think, are just, like, really, really wrong. If you want to make a draw an analogy between the kind of language that's being used now and American history, it pretty much has to be the Civil War. And do we really want that again? I don't.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Back, Tom Hartman here with you. The President of the United States has asked young people in the United States. This he gave the commencement address at Ohio State University on Sunday, and in a speech focused on citizenship. And I want to share some of the things that he had to say, and with loving affection and respect for our president, my thoughts on them, on what he had to say. So, first of all, here's the president about becoming cynical.
When we turn away and get discouraged and cynical and abdicate that authority, we grant our silent consent to someone who will gladly claim it.
Right. And, you know, that someone would be, you know, demagogues, people who say, oh, just give up, don't bother, corporations who want to take over, whatever. But, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. Clip number two.
And that's how we end up with lobbyists who set the agenda and policies detached from what middle-class families face every day. The well-connected who publicly demand that Washington stay out of their business and then whisper in government's ear for special treatment that you don't get. That's how a small minority of lawmakers get cover to defeat something the vast majority of their constituents want. That's how our political system gets consumed by small things when we are a people called to do great things.
Yeah. So there you have basically him saying what I just said. You know, this is what he's talking about. If we get cynical and we turn away from the political process, then the corporations and the billionaires step in and run the show. And they have been. The president didn't call out the Supreme Court on this. I will. But I think it goes larger than that. But here was his call to action on this. And this is clip four. Well, actually, yeah, number four.
Class of 2013, only you can ultimately break that cycle. Only you can make sure the democracy you inherit is as good as we know it can be. But it requires your dedicated and informed and engaged citizenship.
Well, it is going to require citizenship, and it would be nice to have an activist generation. This is a generation coming out of college with the highest level of college debt in the history of the United States. And many of you listening or watching right now are old enough to remember when pretty much nobody graduated with college debt, unless they happen to be, you know, in some major postgraduate program like, you know, an MD or PhD in which case it was a debt that could easily be paid off in the first few years. But then finally to in an almost blame the victim mode, here's the president kind of wrapping this thing up.
We're blessed to live in the greatest nation on earth. But we can always be greater. We can always aspire to something more. It doesn't depend on who you elect to office. It depends on you as citizens, how big you want us to be, how badly you want to see these changes for the better. And look at all that America's already accomplished. Look how big we've been. I dare you, class of 2013, to do better.
So I dare you to do better. That's his call to action. I think we need more than that. I think we need more than a good speech. I think we need more than a call to citizenship, respectfully. There's a great piece over at Alternet, and I'm sorry, the copy I have here does not have the author's name on it, or I would attribute it. I will get it during the break. It's titled Five Ways That Raw Unregulated Capitalism is Acting Like a Cancer on American Society. There's a chapter in one of my books, I think it's my book Threshold, titled The Cancer Stage of Capitalism. It was Paul Buckheit who wrote this. And here's what's going on. These are the things that, frankly, I wish the president would be addressing. These are the kinds of things that Lyndon Johnson used to talk about when he wasn't talking about the Vietnam War. This was the Great Society. This was the stuff that frankly, FDR talked about, obviously. I mean, you know, the Great Depression, that Dwight Eisenhower talked about, that even Richard Nixon talked about. Although a lot of what Nixon talked about was the environment, oddly enough. But the average person who gets food stamps, it's called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. We used to call them food stamps. Now it's a credit card, but whatever. Gets $1,500 for food for the entire year. About $3 a day. About 10 Americans made that much every 10 seconds last year from their investments. So we have fortunes, 47 million Americans, one out of seven need food. 47 million Americans need this SNAP assistance. They literally, you know, they need $1,500 a year worth of food just to keep going. 47 million of us. Almost half of those hungry people are children. And this is absolutely the consequence of Reaganomics, a 32-year failed experiment of Reaganomics. Because in 1980, we had food banks in 1980. We had food banks before that. I remember when I was a little kid, and this was in the mid-1950s, there was a pretty bad recession there, and my dad and mom they'd moved around Michigan, you know, looking for work, and ended up in Lansing. And my dad was selling vacuum cleaners and encyclopedias door to door, which was not really a job. I mean, it was a job; he did it all day long. But Rex Air vacuum cleaners and World Book encyclopedias, we had one of each. In fact, I used to love the encyclopedia. My goal was to go from A to Z and read the entire encyclopedia. I was like 6 or 7 years old, though, so, you know, I didn't get very far. But in any case, I remember on the weekends our going to the surplus food place and getting these giant 20-pound bricks of American cheese and these 20 or 30 or 40-pound bags of macaroni and these 10 or 20-pound boxes of dried powdered skim milk. It was the surplus food store. The government apparently was buying, you know, subsidizing farmers by buying the surplus and then giving it away to, quote, poor people, and which was at that time my dad. And I had at that point two younger brothers. I have three, but I think two of them had been born at that point. So there was, you know, a family of five living in this little three-bedroom house in Lansing, Michigan. For every food bank like that that existed, now that was in the 50s, they were few and far between. Because although we were having a tough time, you know, we weren't down and out. There were still opportunities. Dad could still, you know, fill in the blanks. And then ultimately in 55, 56, 57, I forget what year, I was a little kid at the time. He got this job at Lansing Tool Die, first at Lansing Die Sinking and then Lansing Tool and Die, and worked there for 40 years and made a good living. Died with a pension and full insurance and the whole bit. And fully owning his own home. But the point is that in 1980, for every food bank that existed in 1980, today there are 200 of them. I think this is one of the very best metrics of Reaganomics. Of what Reaganomics has meant to us. For every food bank in America in 1980, when Reagan came into office, today there are 200. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Meanwhile, 20 people made more from their investment income in 1 year than the entire 2011 food stamp budget. Paul Buckeye says. So here we have, welcome back to the program, by the way, here we have 47 million Americans, one out of seven, who need food to get by. You know, I still have that memory of being a little kid and literally having macaroni and cheese every single night for weeks. And I have this very ambivalent relationship with macaroni and cheese. I love macaroni and cheese, and yet it reminds me of you know, it didn't seem to me like a terrible time. I just, you know, couldn't figure out why we were eating macaroni and cheese every single night. I hated, however, the skim milk powder. That was awful. My mom made, you know, you got to drink that. It's good for you. Right. In any case, we have 47 million Americans in a situation that is similar to or far worse in most cases than what my dad experienced, my family experienced during maybe 6 months or a year when my dad couldn't find work during the recession in the middle of the Eisenhower years. And meanwhile, you have 20 individuals in the United States who last year made a total of $73 billion. The vast majority of it at a rate which could not be taxed at the level of, for example, the surgeon who saved Louise's life, which is a maximum of 39%. Or, you know, me, I 39%, if I made that much. I mean, the rest of us. Not that, but a maximum of 20%. Because it's called carried interest, or it's called capital gains, or it's called dividend income. They made $73 billion, these 20 individuals, in 1 year. That's more than the entire 2011 food stamp program budget. And I'm not saying we should take it all away from them and give it to food stamps, but I just find it ironic that in that same year, President Obama could not get Congress to appropriate an additional $1 billion to improve childhood nutrition in schools. In the poorest schools, where in many cases the meal of the day that the kids get is in the school. In fact, most recently, Paul Ryan proposed cutting $2 billion out of the food stamp program. Meanwhile, our students are you know, they're graduating from college with an average of $26,000 in debt. Tuition has risen 10 times faster than the cost of living. Before Ronald Reagan came into office in 1980, the cost of tuition, over 80% of the cost of tuition, was paid for by state, federal, and local governments. schools were heavily subsidized and schools were not-for-profit organizations. You have land-grant colleges like Michigan State University that my mom graduated from that are called land-grant colleges because Abraham Lincoln made these huge grants of land. He'd say, okay, let's get a big enough chunk of land that this land can generate enough money to run a college so that everybody can go to college for free. And let's offer these to all of the states that want them. And Michigan got one. It was Michigan State University. I don't know the names of all the others, but they're out there. And Michigan State has this just, you know, miles and miles and miles of land that they run as agricultural experiments, experimentation programs and stations. And, you know, Louise and her brother used to bicycle through them. And they used to have a cow with a glass wall on its side. And you could watch food going through its intestines. And it was all kinds of strange stuff. And miles of different corn crops and stuff. They would do research for the big ag companies and get paid for that. And that would... You know, so anyhow, the bottom line here is, at other land-grant colleges, they would sell off their timber, you know, and they would just keep growing it back and cutting part of their timber. And it varied from state to state and college to college. But the bottom line was that 80% of the cost of going to college was paid for by state, federal, local governments, or by the colleges themselves. And only tuition was, you know, a little less than 20% when Reagan came into office. And so... You know, my generation and the people who preceded me, my parents' generation, we pretty much didn't know anybody who had serious college debt. I mean, my wife put herself through school working as a waitress in a Howard Johnson's. Riding to work every day and to school on her bicycle. I did not complete college, but for the time that I went to Michigan State University and to Lansing Community College, I was making a living as a DJ, $2.35 an hour, or whatever it was. That's my recollection of what it was. I think that was the minimum wage. For a while, I worked at Henry's Hamburgers, flipping burgers. For a while, I worked at Bob's Big Boy as a dishwasher and then as a cook. And for one day as a waiter, I will, you know, because all the waitresses went on strike that day. And I will, you know, that's why I overtip to this day. Boy, did I have a, scab. It wasn't that they went on strike, it was that they quit. You know, I mean, it was just this, that's it. Okay, we're out of here. And I, you know, anyhow, so I got dragged out of, I went from dishwasher to waiter for that one day. Yeah, in any case. And there was a local Esso station, gas station, where I pumped gas and I repaired tires. And I put myself through college doing that. I never had a penny of college debt. Now, I didn't, like I said, I didn't complete college, but you could do that back then. This was the late 60s, early 70s. I am of a generation that pretty much didn't know college debt, and now we've got kids graduating so loaded with college debt and with a minimum wage that, if it were calibrated in 1969, should be over $10.25. The minimum wage is useless.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And because of this college debt, these kids are not starting businesses, and they're not taking chances, and they are crushed for decades. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, attacking the hunger. We're talking about Paul Buchet's, Buchite. I'm not quite sure how he pronounces it. His piece, The Five Ways That Raw Unregulated Capitalism is Acting Like a Cancer in American Society. You've heard me talk about this for years, that we have achieved, we have reached the cancer stage of capitalism. Number one, attacking the hungry. Number two, suffocating the students. Number three, weakening the children. We are among the 30 OECD countries. This is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It's basically the 30 richest countries in the world. And that is like Costa Rica is one of them. So it's not like there's that many really, really rich countries in the world. But anyhow, we are 27th out of 30 in terms of child poverty. 27th out of 30. half of our kids live in households that are below half of the median income, which is pretty astounding. And then, of course, wiping out the taxpayers, so loopholes and exemptions. You know, the rich, the uber rich, and the corporate rich, they make off with at least $1 trillion a year in tax loopholes. And then, you know, on top of that, we've got $37 trillion in offshore accounts. And then paralyzing the voters. So anyhow, this was his piece. I commend it to you. It's over at alternate.com or .org, excuse me. But the point, I think, is well taken, that we have achieved the cancer stage of capitalism. So what are we going to do about that? Well, I think that what we need to do as a very straightforward process is, number one, clean up our tax code, start out by doing away with the capital gains exemption. If somebody earns money, a dollar should be a dollar. Somebody earns a dollar by being, you know, born a member of the Lucky Sperm Club and, you know, being Paris Hilton, sit around the pool by the, with a Mai Tai all day waiting for the dividend check to arrive. If that's how you earn your living, by inheriting money, that's fine. On the dividend income from that, pay the same as an engineer or a surgeon. What's wrong with that? Why should Mitt Romney's income be different? Why should he pay a different rate of income tax than his secretary? Say, well, the money that his income comes from was already taxed. Well, so was hers. And the income before that was taxed, and the income before that was, you know, it's at every stage. I mean, you buy something in a store, you pay sales tax, the store pays a tax, they pay their employees pay taxes, their employees buy things, they pay tax. Hey, you know, come on. This is like the old W.C. Fields joke about fish and water. Anyhow, Eric, this is just a starting point for me. Eric in Colbert, Washington. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
Good.
How about you?
Hey, I've been listening to you for a long time. I appreciate your intellect and your well-researched opinions you bring to the national debate. It's very refreshing. I've always wanted to call and comment because I'm also a graduate of Michigan State. So every time you mention, I'm like, man, I got to call Tom and talk to
him. Although, let me make it clear, I'm not a graduate. I got...
Oh, right, yeah. Right. Yeah, and I finally just learned that just now.
Somewhere between kicked out and dropped out.
I live out here in eastern Washington, and Washington State was also one of the first land-grant universities.
Oh, cool.
Established about the same time Michigan State was.
Which would have been in the 1860s, because this was Abe Lincoln's gig.
Right, correct. And it's incidentally, too, Michigan State and Washington State, two of the best veterinary research institutions, schools in the country.
Probably because both of them have a lot of land, and so because that's how the land-grant colleges worked, and so they've got enough land to have ruminant, you know, animals like cattle, you know, that they can do research with and on and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Washington State has got an outstanding vet school.
Mm-hmm.
Domestic and ag animal care program down there. In fact, I think it just opened a brand new multi-million dollar research facility and vet hospital down there at Washington State in Pullman.
Hmm.
But two of the most affordable, highest quality education universities in the country. You know, doing your research, U.S. News, World Report, and you always talk about how affordable and what a good quality education can be provided at Washington State. Michigan State also makes that list. Texas A&M, I believe, was also one of the first land-grant universities. And one in Florida, I believe, comes to mind as well. But you go and look in any of the schools we used to call or currently call them their mascots, the Aggie, I think we're part of the original land-grant system.
Huh, interesting. I'm going to have to, you know, I'm sure that there's a simple list on the internet. There's probably a Wikipedia page for it that just lists who they are, and I should have probably printed it out before I started, although I didn't realize I was going to go off on a land-grant rant. But the fact of the matter is that Thomas Jefferson thought that it was more important. He designed his own tombstone. He wrote his own epitaph on his tombstone. And he thought it was more important to say that he was the founder of the University of Virginia, a free college, absolutely tuition-free, that he was the founder of the University of Virginia. It was more important to say that than that he was president of the United States. On his tombstone, it does not say he was president of the United States. It says that he was the author of the Virginia Declaration of Religious Rights, that he was, you know, in other words, he was very, very concerned about separation of church and state, that he was the author of the Declaration of Independence, and that he was the founder of the University of Virginia. That's what he wanted to be remembered for. And it was a free college, and that was his whole thing, is, you know, free education. Abe Lincoln, free education. You know, we have to invest in the intellectual infrastructure of the future. And the entire state of California had this incredible university system, you know, in 1968. I didn't go to school there, but a number of my friends moved out to California. I spent the summer of 68 out in San Francisco. And, you know, people going to USF and UC Berkeley and whatnot, you know, it was free. It was free if you just, you know, if you just lived in the state long enough to get in-state status, which, as I recall, back then was only 6 months. Then you could, of course, Ronald Reagan put an end to that. He said, we can't have that. These kids, you know, go to college. They're out there protesting against me. I don't like that at all. And so now the University of California is no longer free. Pretty much nothing is free anymore. So, Eric, thanks for the shout out and thanks for, you know, the information. Justin, it says, you disagree. I have to understand that the top three people pay 95% of all taxes. Really?
Yes.
The top three people in America pay 95% of all taxes?
The top 3% of earners in America pay 95% of the income taxes paid.
Okay. And you don't think that the top 3% of earners don't make more than 95% of all the gains in income every year? In fact, they made more than 110% of all the gains in income every year. For the last decade.
I agree with one point you said. You said, you know, dollar for dollar.
So let's just say, you know, regardless of how you earn your money, you're going to have to pay the same rate of income tax. Yeah, okay. Justin, I'm with you on that. Thanks for the call. Mike in Vail, Arizona. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I thoroughly enjoy your show. You know, I'm of the opinion, Tom, that big money is going to in politics is going to ruin state and local elections if they haven't already.
Yeah, it's already pretty much there.
Well, and, you know, when we have the groups like the NRA that can use fear tactics and threatening tactics and reach, you know, across the country and have a significant impact on a local election, I don't get it, Tom. How could Clarence Thomas and the rest of his boys, how could they even, you know, sign off on Citizens United? Just doesn't make sense to me, Tom.
The doctrine that the Supreme Court has operated under for well over a century, but particularly since the 1970s, has been basically a doctrine that, and Mike, thank you for the call. Thanks for raising the topic so I can riff on this for a moment for the minute I have left. Has basically been the doctrine that was the principal economic theory of the UK and of Europe throughout most of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, which was if a small number of very wealthy people have virtually all the money and all the political power, and a large number of very poor people have very little power and are largely disempowered but are kept just above the level of starvation, that society will be stable, and that stability in society is far more desirable than equality in society. That equality is an evil, but that's that stuff Karl Marx talked about, that stability is important. That's that stuff William F. Buckley talked about. And so the Supreme Court, by deciding over and over and over again, most recently limiting the rights of people to have class action lawsuits, for example. The Supreme Court over and over and over again has taken the position of big corporations and wealthy, wealthy individuals over that of the little guy or of unions or of women or of minorities. And that's why.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In 1803, they turned this republic into a constitutional monarchy, and they are continuing to function along the philosophical lines of constitutional monarchy. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Let's check in with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, earlier today, the UN human rights investigators, in the person of Commission member Carla Del Ponte, a former Swiss attorney general who also served as a prosecutor for the International Criminal Investigation into Yugoslavia, said that they were pretty sure that the rebels in Syria had used chemical weapons. In fact, they said there were strong concrete suspicions, but not yet incontrovertible proof of the use of sarin gas and that it had been used by the rebels. Well, later today, the UN panel investigating claims of human rights abuses walked that back pretty swiftly, saying they wished to clarify that the panel has not yet reached conclusive findings as to the use of chemical weapons in Syria by any parties to the conflict, and as a result, the commission is not in a position to further comment on the allegations at this time.
Yeah, because here's my guess of what's going on. Tell me if this makes any sense to you.
Yeah.
In all probability, it was the rebels, although, because I don't think Bashar is, or Assad is that nuts, that he wants to bring down, he doesn't want to end his own regime. But if the rebels did it thinking that this would bring in the international community, that they could blame it on him. But, you know, the argument that the Russians are making, and I think actually it's a good argument, is the Assad government is a secular government. If it goes down, you're going to see it replaced by a religious government that is probably going to be an al-Qaeda affiliated religious government. And that's not going to be a good thing. And that's not just the argument the Russians are making, actually. There's a strong argument like that being made within the U.S. State Department. On the other hand, the Assad government is not viable. You know, I mean, it's just, so what do you do? It's like one of those really, really, really messy situations.
It's a really, really, really messy situation. No, I think that's possible. I think it's also possible that there are mid-level or fairly high-level officers within the Assad regime who may have released the sarin. And it's interesting that there are, in the Reuters story that I have, there are reports of a Syrian doctor with the Union of Syrian Medical Relief Organizations and a Turkish doctor also saying that they think that in their tests that they found sarin, but they found diluted sarin, which says to them that they think that sarin has been used and that it may have been used by the regime, but that it was used not to kill, because this diluted sarin wouldn't have killed, but it was used to terrorize.
Hmm. Wow.
Which is very interesting.
Yeah. And meanwhile,
widespread deaths.
Yeah, and at the time we're talking about this, Secretary of State John Kerry, is in Moscow, is he not?
That's right. He is in Moscow for talks. And he is obviously going to be trying to say to the Russians, hey, you know, we'd like you to get on board with us, and we think that it's time for Assad to go, and the Russians are going to say exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
And we're not going to move anywhere.
Yeah. And meanwhile, this is going to drag out and drag out, and this is just not a good thing. On the other hand, you know, well, anyway, what else is going on?
Very interesting. The Texas fertilizer plant in West that exploded 2 weeks ago, killing 14, injuring about 200, and blowing up extraordinary hole, was a repeat target of theft by intruders who tampered with tanks and caused the release of toxic chemicals. Reuters has done a lot of digging here, and they got hold of police records, 911 dispatch logs, criminal offense reports, all kinds of things. They got through an open records request. they've got, the police responded to at least 11 reports of burglaries and 5 separate ammonia leaks at West Fertilizer over the last 12 years.
Wow.
And some of the leaks were linked to theft of interference with tank valves.
Now, were these people stealing fertilizer because they wanted to grow crops, or were these people stealing ammonium nitrate because they wanted to build bombs like Tim McVeigh did?
Well, according to one 2002 crime report, a plant manager told police intruders were stealing 4 to 5 gallons of anhydrous ammonia every 3 days, and that can be used to cook methamphetamine.
Oh.
Yes.
The plot thickens.
Yes.
Huh.
It's very interesting.
If that's producing kilos of methamphetamines, we're talking millions of dollars.
However, even though the cause of the blast is still being probed, there's been no indication that the explosion had anything to do with the theft of materials for drug making. And anhydrous ammonia has been ruled out as a cause because the 4 storage tanks remained intact after the blast.
So they still don't know what caused the blast.
No, but they're hoping to know by May the 10th. They're pursuing about 100 leads, including a call to an arson hotline and a tip that there'd been a fire on the property earlier in the day. They've got about 80 investigators working on it.
Okay.
It's very, very intriguing.
Yeah, yeah.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is about to start issuing fines, interestingly, starting tomorrow when a new final rule under the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Law starts to take effect.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be for violators of people who violate consumer financial protection laws.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they can bring action against any party, whether an individual or a company. And the civil penalties collected will be deposited in a new fund, and every 6 months, the agency will pay victims.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is for fraud based on things like ripping people off on their credit card fees and that kind of thing?
Exactly.
So this is for consumers, and they're going to pay back consumers. This isn't like, oh, we're going to make some money to bail out banksters.
No, this is not for bailing out banksters.
This is like for taking the money from the banksters.
Basically, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds like good news to me. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goats for the old goat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our third hour. Jacob Dean is our associate producer emeritus. For years helped us put together this program and helped run the show. And those of you who are longtime listeners, you probably know his name well. Jacob now is back in Portland. He actually followed us out here to D.C. and worked with us for about a year and had a family emergency. Had to go back to Portland. So anyhow, the Hartman show program family, all of us are trying to help him get a scholarship from Democracy for America to go to the Netroots convention. And if you haven't clicked to vote for him, get over to tomhartman.com. There's a link on our homepage, and we're to the place where you can vote for Jacob Dean. If you remember Jacob, you know, let's try and get him that scholarship. On Sunday, President Obama gave the commencement address to the 2013 graduates of the Ohio State University. And he spoke to the graduates, and I realize I'm somewhat repeating what I was riffing on in the last hour, but let me just get through this. Because I think that this is, well, it's a slight variation on the same theme, but it's an important one. He spoke to the graduates about the voices of cynicism surrounding America today, and he said, reject that cynicism. Challenge the new students or the new graduates, the new college graduates, to tackle the issues of today with strength and determination. In fact, he closed his remarks with, is it clip 5, Shane? He closed his remarks with this.
I dare you, class of 2013, to do better. I dare you to dream bigger.
Okay. And clip number one as well, if you could.
When we turn away and get discouraged and cynical and abdicate that authority, we grant our silent consent to someone who will gladly claim it.
Okay. So it's easy to say to someone, don't be too cynical. But look at the environment that these graduates are stepping out into. Students graduating this year from college will be the most indebted class in history. Their college loan debt is going to haunt them for much of their adult life. And that's not just the bad news for them. It's bad news. It's not bad news just for them. Excuse me. It's bad news for our entire economy. According to the Young Entrepreneur Council, the piles of student loan debt that graduates find themselves buried under are preventing them from becoming entrepreneurs and starting small businesses. And small businesses have traditionally been the backbone of the American economy. The decline in college graduates becoming entrepreneurs and small business owners is partly to blame for the demise of small businesses in America today. According to statistics in the U.S. Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics, the percentage of self-employed Americans, also known as entrepreneurs, is at an all-time low. Since Ronald Reagan departed the White House, having set up decades of Reaganomics, the number of startup jobs per 1,000 Americans has decreased by nearly 30%. As a share of the population, the percentage of Americans who are self-employed fell by more than 20% between 1991 and 2010. And according to the U.S. Census Bureau, our economy lost more than 220,000 small businesses, not just business people, businesses during the Great Bush Recession. So in addition to student loan debt, there are a whole bunch of other parts of Reaganomics and Clintonomics that help explain the decline of small businesses in America. Over at the Economic Collapse blog, Michael T. Snyder, a political commentator and Drudge Report favorite, gives his take on why small businesses experience such a decline in America. He points to things like ridiculous regulations and Obamacare as the main culprits behind the death of small business, and argues that corporate taxes are hindering business creation, but that our effective, that is, collected corporate tax rates, the reality is, that our effective corporate tax rates in America are the second lowest in the developed world. And corporate tax collections are the lowest they've been in decades, even in the face of the highest corporate profits in the history of our republic. In reality, the demise of small business in America can be tracked back to the presidency of one man, Ronald Reagan. In June 16th, 1998, then chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, Robert Petofsky, testified before Congress about, quote, mergers and corporate consolidation in the new economy, end quote. This was, you know, the whole M&A thing was starting to get a little old. It went hysterical in the early 80s when Reagan changed the rules and said we're not going to enforce the Sherman Act and all that kind of stuff. But people were starting to get spooked about it. So he comes along to testify. These mergers, of course, have made it harder and harder for small businesses to start or compete in the United States. And so Petofsky, in his testimony, talked about why, all these various reasons, why we were seeing so many big businesses merge or consolidate. He pointed to globalization of competition as one driving factor behind the mergers in the 90s. Small business people couldn't compete with cheap labor overseas after Reagan began the changes in our trade policies, and big business could afford to ship their factories to low-wage, high-pollution countries. He then talked about the role that deregulation has in influencing mergers and consolidations. Petofsky argued, quote, many mergers are taking place in industries undergoing or anticipating deregulation. In the 80s, the commission reviewed a substantial number of mergers in the natural gas industry, which was then undergoing deregulation. Now deregulatory changes are taking place in electricity, telecommunications, banking, and financial services. End of quote. He went on to say that these mergers could hurt competition. Quote, some mergers can harm competition. The harm to competition, in turn, can harm consumers in many ways. Higher prices, restricted supply of products, lower quality goods and services, less variety from which to choose, and less innovation for the future. End of quote. Reagan ushered in the age of mergers and consolidation when he stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1982. His abandonment of that and subsequent antitrust laws have allowed corporations to grow to unprecedented sizes, all the while crushing small businesses in America. Most American jobs are created historically by small businesses and through individual entrepreneurship. But Reagan allowed small businesses to be eaten up by giant transnational corporations through hostile takeovers and leveraged buyouts. He changed the rules so that corporate predators like Mitt Romney's Bain Capital could squash small businesses on Main Street USA, sucking the wealth and prosperity out of communities across our country. Before Reagan stepped foot inside the White House, mom-and-pop businesses drove our economy. Main streets were bustling with locally owned stores. Strip malls were packed with locally owned shops. Today, all across America, both Main Street and malls are nothing more than the same giant corporate clothing stores, restaurants, jewelry stores, electronic shops. The days of the locally owned business are dead. One part of the American dream used to be about coming up with an idea and starting your own business. It was about hiring local members of the community to build that business. It was about making good money, saving for retirement, being able to take a vacation every now and then, and offering the same to your employees. But thanks to Reaganomics, that vision of the American dream is no more, by and large. And small business in America is on life support. So conservatives, they can try to blame Obama, smokestack regulations, and Obamacare, like Drudge is, you know, doing today, for the death of small business in America, all they want. But anybody who knows history knows otherwise. Reaganomics is what killed small business in America and continues to kill small business in America. And frankly, things like, you know, Obamacare and some decent regulation of these very large corporations could bring back small businesses in America. Shano gave me a list of, by the way, land-grant colleges, the free, what used to be the free universities. It's mind-boggling. I thought there was like 10 of them. There's this whole long list of them. Anyhow, I'll share that with you after the break. We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour, and we'll pick up your calls, too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do we bring back small business in America? It's simple. Roll back Reaganomics. How do we do that? That's where it gets complicated. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And there was something. We were just talking about Ted Cruz. Anyway. Yeah, land-grant colleges. Yeah, that's fine. Oh, the list of land-grant. Yeah, I knew that I had promised. Here it is right here. Land-grant university and the history. The Agricultural College of the State of Michigan was started in 1855. It was the first land-grant institution. And it was given 14,000 acres of state-owned land. The Farmers High School of Pennsylvania, later to become Pennsylvania State University, followed in February of that year. And basically what this did, now this was before the Lincoln administration. And so Lincoln came in and he looked at this and he said, boy, this is kind of cool. Let's do something like this. And that became I think it's called the Morrill Act. M-O-R-E-L-L. Hang on just a second, I can tell you. Yeah, M-O-R-R-I-L-L. The Morrill Act of 1862 that got the federal government in the business. And so now in Alabama, these are all land-grant institutions. In other words, these were all at one time free colleges or intended to be free or damn near free, very close to free. Alabama A&M University, Tuskegee University, Auburn University, in Alaska, the University of Alaska system, the entire system. In American Samoa, the American Samoa Community College. In Arizona, the University of Arizona. In Arkansas, University of Arkansas at Fayetteville and at Pine Bluff. In California, the University of California, the entire system. UC Berkeley was the very first of the California land-grant colleges. Colorado State University, Connecticut, University of Connecticut, and the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. Delaware State University, University of Delaware, University of the District of Columbia, Florida A&M, University of Florida, Florida State. You know, again, these all used to be free colleges. University of Georgia. Two of my kids are UGA graduates. It's still relatively inexpensive with in-state tuition and the Pell Grants and things, but it's, you know. University of Guam, the University of Hawaii, University of Idaho, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, Purdue in Indiana, Purdue University, land-grant colleges, Iowa State University of Science and Technology, founded in 1862. Iowa was the first state to accept a provision of the Morrill Act designating Iowa State as a land-grant institution. Kansas State University, Kentucky State University, University of Kentucky, Louisiana State University System, Southern University and A&M College in Louisiana, University of Maine, University of Maryland, Eastern Shore and College Park, University of Massachusetts at Amherst, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, Michigan State University, Mississippi State University and Alcorn State University in Mississippi, Lincoln University and the University of Missouri in Missouri, in Montana, Montana State University, in Nebraska, University of Nebraska, Nevada, University of Nevada, Reno, in New Hampshire, the University of New Hampshire. It goes on and on. I mean, through New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, Rhode Island, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Texas A&M, Prairie View A&M, Utah, Vermont, University of Vermont, Virgin Islands, Virginia, Washington, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Wyoming, University of Wyoming, land-grant colleges, land-grant universities. We have a history in this country of investing in our educational infrastructure, in our young people. And what Reaganomics did was basically say, anything that the government invests in is a bad idea because it should be an opportunity for private profit. And so it used to be that if you wanted to run a college or a school, it had to be a not-for-profit organization, and many of them were run by states, or funded by the states. Pre-Reagan, keep in mind, a little more than 80% of all tuition costs, all costs of going to college, were paid for by local, state, or federal governments, or the colleges themselves. Now that number is in the neighborhood of 20%. It's been just a complete reverse. Why did that happen? Well, it's Reaganomics. It's, you know, that's big government when you're supporting universities. Can't have big government. And besides that, if somebody has to spend a lot of money for their tuition and they don't come from a rich family, they're going to have to borrow that money. If they borrow that money, that's an opportunity for profit for the banks. And then when they changed the bankruptcy laws during the Bush administration, this was like in, 2007, I think it was, they changed the bankruptcy laws to say, oh, yeah, you declare bankruptcy, you can keep some things, and there are, you have to pay your taxes, though. You can't declare bankruptcy on taxes. Used to be that was it, the only thing you couldn't declare bankruptcy on. And there even actually used to, back in the day, there were provisions to even, get your taxes adjusted. But now you can't declare bankruptcy on your student debt. So these are like no-risk loans. And the banksters are making a fortune on this stuff. And Obama took it away from them 2 years ago. He said, the federal government has been backing the banksters, and then the banksters have been adding a profit onto this for the student loans. He said, we'll save $80 billion a year if we just take the banksters out of the equation. That's how much profit these banks were skimming off the top. So he took the banksters out of the equation. So student loans now are less, less expensive. I know college may be more expensive, so it doesn't seem that way. But they're less expensive than they were before the Obama presidency. But, the net is still there. Kids are having to borrow to go to school. School should be free in this country. We need to invest in our intellectual infrastructure. We need to roll back this whole concept, the whole Reaganomics concept.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
This Friedrich Hayek, von Mises, this bizarre idea that everything should be turned into profit is just wrong. The bad and the very, very Chthonianly ugly. The good. Bertrand Piccard and André Borschberg. The two Swiss pilots finished the first part of their solar-powered flight across the United States this past weekend. Their plane, the Solar Impulse, uses the sun's rays as its sole source of power and can fly both day and night. Piccard and Borschberg landed in Phoenix, Arizona on Sunday and will continue on to Dallas, St. Louis, and New York in coming days. The pair hopes to use the Solar Impulse to raise awareness about solar power. Borschberg told reporters that if we don't try to fly today using renewable energy, we never will. Well said, André, and good luck on the rest of your voyage. The bad. Niall Ferguson. Speaking to hundreds of financial analysts and executives at a conference in Carlsbad, California this past week, the Harvard economist claimed that John Maynard Keynes, the famous British economist, was a bad scholar because he was gay. According to Ferguson, Keynes was an effete man who didn't have any children because he was a homosexual interested in ballet and poetry. Apparently without a son or daughter to call his own and distracted by his effeminate interests, Keynes had no reason to care about the future or the impact of his ideas on coming generations. Compelling theory, Niall. Professor Ferguson has since apologized for his remarks, but the fact that a supposedly important public intellectual would even consider, let alone make such bigoted comments, is just embarrassing. And the very, very ugly Pat Robertson. On a recent episode of the 700 Club, the televangelist defended gay conversion therapy because religion, he said, can help reform murderers and rapists. Seriously, check this out.
Power of God can change people's orientation. A murderer can change. A rapist can change. A thief can change. That's what the gospel is all about.
Well, I guess it's nice to know that Pat is on the side of reformers when it comes to issues of criminal justice. Comparing homosexuality to murder is just plain bigoted and very, very ugly. Mind-bogglingly ugly. Texas House approves 12 new firearms bills to put more guns in classrooms. It's like at a certain point, you just go, okay, you know, my head is exploding. It's incredible. It's just incredible. Dave in Arcata, California, listening on KTLE, or a.k.a. Bertrand Russell. How you doing, Dave?
Yes, that's right. I'm also Bertrand Russell in your chat room, and I go back with your show since the earliest days when you came on KTOE in Eureka, and the late Alice and I used to talk to you several times a week. That's back when one didn't get left on hold for an hour and a half.
Yeah, my apologies. The show is a lot smaller than it's.
I know that. And I also know that you share many of our concerns about election integrity, and that's the main issue that's been concerning us. Some of us feel it has to be discussed loud and often.
Mm-hmm.
We are asking the question in the chat room, how does a greedy 1% end up with half the power of a government in an honest democracy?
Mm-hmm.
How can that happen? And we're coming to the conclusion that it has a lot to do with this electronic voting. You've spoken of it often.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you share our concerns. I'm just hearing now that one state has just thrown out the electronic voting, and it gets no news coverage. You
really?
Haven't mentioned it.
Okay, I confess this. Today has been a crazy busy day because I'm doing during the breaks at the bottom of the hour. We're doing fundraising. I'm staying live and doing fundraising for Free Speech TV. So I haven't had a chance to really get in and read what's going on in the chat room. Let me just take a look here at. Guns. Okay. Well, you know, in any case, I'm with you on the whole issue of electronic voting. I do not know for sure that there is a state that has done away with that, but put the, you know, if pass that link along again, please, Sue, if that's there and it's been verified. And 409 says Bertrand Russell gets through to Hartman. Go, Bertrand. And I will publicize it. You know, I think that Bernie Sanders, I mean, on this program over and over again has said, let's just go back to paper. You know, it's reliable. Holland, I think, was the country that said that we're going to sell our voting machines. Oh, it was Ireland. Thank you, Shano. Ireland. So they sold their electronic voting machines for scrap metal. Canada experimented with them, gave up on it. It's crazy. Electronic voting machines.
Every other country in the civilized world has thrown them out. And, you know,
is interesting. Now, hang on just a second here. I see the link here from Jules, and it's a link from theblaze.com. That's Glenn Beck's website, you realize.
I don't know.
Yeah. I you know, until I see it at bradblog.com, I'm not going to trust something that comes off Glenn Beck's website. But let me look into it, Dave. Thank you for the heads up on that, and I totally agree with you. Electronic voting is, well, and not just electronic voting. There's a whole bunch of different ways that voters get ripped off by, you know, controlling the voting rolls. I mean, the best estimate right now, if you look at Mark Crispin Miller's work and Greg Palast's work, is that in the last election, the election of 2012, probably somewhere between 7 and 9 million voters thought they voted and didn't. You know, people got or were not allowed to vote, and they should have. And so, you know, every election they add another million or two people that they knock off the voting rolls. This is, it's a crazy thing. Cameron in Washington, D.C., listening on Sirius. Hey, Cameron, what's up?
Hello, Tom. I have a slightly grim thought matter, but I wanted to get your opinion. A couple of times over the last few months, you said that it's sad that the availability of guns leads to as many suicides, the increase in suicide rate in the last few years. And I was wondering if you think someone that does not have children and that's living in pain and agony and it's getting worse year after year, whether you think that they should not have the right to end their lives?
No, I'm actually, I lived in Oregon when the Right to Die with Dignity law was passed, and we debated that loudly on my program. I did a morning show on KPOJ at the time in addition to this national show. And so, you know, so for 3 hours we just talked about Oregon politics. And Oregon and Washington State are the two states that have this Right to Die with Dignity law in place, and I'm a big fan of it. I'm an advocate of it. The laws require that two physicians certify that you are within 6 months of being terminal, that you are of sound mind, and that you are in pain. And then what they do is they give you a prescription for phenobarbital, or one of the drugs very closely related to phenobarbital, and that is orange, you know, 6 ounces of a little orange drink, and you just chug that down and basically go to sleep, and after about 12 hours, stop breathing. But you have to, in order to get that prescription filled, you have to have these two physicians sign off on it. Now my concern is that having the ability to quickly and with what is perceived as being painlessly kill yourself causes some people, and this just comes out of my own experience. When I was just after I'd left high school, one of my best friends from junior high school, a fellow by the name of Clark, killed himself. He had gone off to the Army. It was during the Vietnam time. He came back from basic training, and he came out to actually talk with me. It was around Christmas time. And, you know, we talked one evening. He was really, really depressed. He was really sad. He was very concerned about going to Vietnam. He just didn't know what he was going to do. And a couple of days later, I got a call from his wife that, to come over immediately. And he'd taken a gun and just, you know, blown the back of his head all over the wall. And that happens a lot. That happens more than it should. And it happens more in the United States than it happens in other countries, although there is a relationship between the availability of guns and that kind of easy suicide. And I'm personally of the opinion, having known Clark for a third of both of our lives, that had he, you know, been bummed out, but still, you know, gone back, had, and not had access to a gun, that he probably wouldn't have killed himself, that he would have gone back, you know, God only knows what would have happened. I mean, he might have ended up being killed in Vietnam or something, but that he would have made it through. And I think that that's the story for a lot of people who commit suicide with guns. And that's why I talk about suicide with guns. It's not that I'm opposed to the death with dignity laws. Am I making sense, Cameron?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for the call and for the thoughtful call. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. We got a minute to the break, Paul. It's yours.
I wanted to talk about, you're talking about the Land Grant College Act, the Morrow Land Grant College Act.
Mm-hmm.
That was, that was by then Congressman Justin Morrow, who became a 6-term senator of Vermont and also wrote the Morrow Anti-Bigamy Act, which President Lincoln signed, which,
oh, really? Was that the law that outlawed Mormonism, basically?
Pretty much, yeah. They didn't like him. Which drove the Romneys into Mexico, as it goes.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah, and it was challenged in 1878 and upheld by the Supreme Court. But nonetheless, I was going to say about the SNAP program, I looked into that. I had a debate with a conservative talk host. Guy with frizzy hair and a mustache who does movie reviews, but never mind. They keep harping on the 47% takers, and the last farm bill, this food stamps are part of the farm bill, as are all nutrition programs. The last one was signed by President Bush.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Paul had that one timed right out. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And the news of the day is filled with amazing stuff. You know, just amazing stuff. Like Jim Porter, the new NRA president. He says the NRA is going to shift away from this whole national fight thing that they seem to be losing and into the courts. He's going to take on New York, Connecticut, Maryland, and Colorado. And Colorado just passed this, you know, fairly restrictive gun law. I mean, just like in the last month or so. And the NRA is going to start suing because Jim Porter is a lawyer. So he's replacing David Keene, who is not. Meanwhile, two pilots are traveling around the world, or they're going to try to. In a plane, it was called the Solar Impulse. It took off on the first leg of the journey Friday, leaving San Francisco Bay for Phoenix. This is a solar-powered airplane. And they're going to go around the world. Think about that. That's pretty amazing. That's very amazing. I mean, this is the Wright brothers kind of thing, right? I mean, the Wright brothers did this airplane thing, and then everybody said, oh, that's cute. You know, two guys who make bicycles, you know, they made an airplane and they flew, 65 feet or something. What's the big deal? Why does anybody care? And then a little later on, the Wright brothers called up the railroad companies and said, hey, we got this invention. You want to buy it? And the railroad company said, no, we're in the railroad business. We're not. You know, what would we want an airplane for? They didn't realize they were in the transportation business, or at least so goes the perhaps apocryphal story. But if this is the Wright brothers, I mean, you know, it could be if these guys are, you know, in that curve, it could be, you know, a decade from now, jet planes, airplanes will not be powered by fossil fuels anymore. And if we can stop the fossil fuel burning within a decade, we might be able to save this planet. That's pretty impressive stuff. So this is like a really important first step because jet planes consume a lot of fuel. There's a lot of flights. I mean, on a person per mile basis, it's one of the most efficient ways to travel, far more efficient than driving, uses a lot less fuel, but still there's a lot of people flying. So if that could all be solar powered, that'd be really cool. Larry in Crescent, Larry just dropped off. So Alfredo in Mountain View, California. Hey Alfredo, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment about, you know, the voting, paper voting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I live in California, and I vote by mail.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some states like Oregon now, they basically vote
mm-hmm.
by mail. And
yeah.
so that solves the issue of all these computerized voting fraud machines.
Mm-hmm.
And but I want to also to allude to the point that you were making earlier about both parties, you know, this, one party disenfranchising, you know, many voters. In fact, both parties, and I have mentioned this to you before, both parties are involved in disenfranchising third-party
mm-hmm.
candidates like myself. And so, you know, I really dislike these two duopoly, monopoly system that we have.
I do too, but it's built into our Constitution. And so until we change, until you get a critical mass of states that either go with instant runoff voting or fusion voting or proportional representation, and there are ways to accomplish all those things at the state level, state by state, until you get a critical mass of states to do that, you're going to be stuck with a two-party system. And so I would say, you know, become an activist around that topic. There are some very, very good, you know, groups and sites that are working just on that issue. And, you know, go for it. I support you. Terry, because I, you know, I'd like to see more than just two parties. But given right now that basically we've got two parties, then I'd say let's do this inside-outside strategy that Tim Carpenter over at Progressive Democrats of America is doing. Join pdamerica.org and participate. Terry in Fort Shaw, Montana. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Tom, I'm a great fan, and I really enjoy your callers, too. And on your point of the greatest threat to freedom there, and I was arguing with myself, I agree with your apathy, but I wonder if ignorance perhaps being more prevalent. That was my first thought. I'd be curious to
yeah.
know yours.
Well, ignorance is kind of what I was thinking. I mean, it's a variation on it. It's like the I don't care, I don't know. Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't disagree with that. Good one, Terry. Thank you for the call. Go ahead.
I think perhaps the greatest thing that I see personally, I'm 65 and a veteran and, you know, paid lots of taxes and everything, but with the young that with their social network and everything, they really don't interconnect with other people, and I expect, I know they're not ignorant, but apathy does seem more prevalent with their social networking nowadays, electronically.
At least political apathy. But, you know, that varies from topic to topic. I mean, you know, if you're talking about, for example, gay marriage or the decriminalization of drugs, there's some of these folks, some of these young people are very, very politically active. It's just, you know, picking the topic. So, Terry, thanks for the call. Cecil, we got a little less than a minute to the topic, to the end of this show today. You had a quick comment about Tennessee.
Yeah, just moved here. Was sitting in traffic while I was listening to you. And noticed the truck next to me has an NRA license plate, Tennessee NRA license plate.
Really?
I said, oh, my God.
The state of Tennessee offers a customized, what are they called? Personalized vanity plates? Yeah, an NRA vanity plate. That's amazing. Whew. Cecil, thanks for the heads up on that. That's sweet. Coming up tomorrow, the latest news and information on what's happening in Congress. Good, Congress gets together tomorrow. This should be entertaining. Plus, you know, my thoughts, your thoughts, and all everything in between on this. But don't forget, democracy begins when we show up. Get out there. Go to free-don.org to help Don Siegelman out. Go to TomHartman.com and click on the link to help Jacob Dean get his DFA scholarship. Go to PDAmerica.org, MoveToAmend.org. There's so much you can do. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.